I miss going to the movies, man.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I even when I could go to the movies, I didn't go to the movies. But then again, I didn't go much of anywhere, so.
I went to the movies enough that I paid for one of those, like, pay $20 a month and go as much as you want deals.
That was almost enough to get me back there, actually. Did you feel like you were getting your money's worth out of that?
It was kind of cyclical. Like, so I paid for the AMC one, which was at the Metreon downtown. And, like, you know how when you're at GDC, sometimes you're at a conference at Moscone and you have like 3 hours between meetings and you don't want to go be social. You just want to go have a quiet, dark room.
Sure.
And
yeah.
I'm pretty sure I watched Captain Marvel 2 or 3 times during GDC one year.
I have great admiration for people who are impulsive enough to just go see a movie on the spot. I don't think I'm capable of it.
Yeah. Like if we had had that when we worked downtown, when I was still working downtown and like, it was just like get off Muni or BART, or walk from the office to the movie theater, I would have gone all the time.
That's amazing. Like the idea of to be standing right next to the movie theater and then just on the spot to say, I'm going to go see a movie is like mind blowing to me. Like,
you don't do that? Oh, it's the best.
Like every movie I've ever seen in my life required like 48 hours of contemplation.
Sometimes we're very different people.
Yeah.
But so I just saw that Alamo is doing this thing where if you pay $150 and guarantee $150 in food and bev, you can rent a whole theater.
Wow.
For you and your like your Rona pod.
Is there any minimum number of people? Could that be like for 4 people?
It could be for 1 person. It looks like if you're willing to buy like $150 worth of food at the Alamo, not that
that's
much.
Probably not that hard to do.
Yeah, I could do that.
It's like 3 beers.
It's more than that, but you get one of those. Look, you have to avoid the popcorn and you get into the novelty food,
you know,
the pot stickers and the whatever themed food is.
Got to go for a high caloric density, high calorie to money, right? To cost
high
ratio.
Calorie to mass. Yeah. Yes. You don't want to get a lot of, yeah. I just wonder how, like, can you get them to show whatever you want?
Oh, I didn't think about that. I thought you meant you had to be seeing a first run, like whatever was on. What, could you just bring your own?
I mean,
so here's a thumb drive. Just pull up the MKV on there.
Yeah. Look, here's my Plex login. I got you. What would I like to see? There's like a handful of movies that I never saw in theaters that I would love to see in theaters. Like Alien is okay. On that. I never saw Alien in theaters.
Sure.
I'm into this idea a lot, but I think 3 people, $100 a person is a lot. I'd have to get another. We'd have to like diagonally sit in opposite corners of the theater with like another 3 or 4 people to make the finances work.
Yeah,
for it.
Yeah, does the social distancing kind of undermine the group social aspect a little bit? Maybe. I guess
I don't know.
I guess if it's your theater, you can just holler and heckle all you want, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like do a double feature, watch Happy Bill Gilmore and Billy Madison and, blaze up, have a good time, live large.
Yeah, we really are different people.
Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad. I brought the emails.
You brought the you have the emails?
Sitting here looking at, let's see, all of them are labeled.
Okay.
Just about half of them are also starred. I don't know if that denotes anything special about those emails.
That means that I marked them as special, not knowing that you were labeling them.
Okay.
Because we have a plan, but we have not communicated the new order of emails.
Yes, a new order is rising in our shared Gmail account.
Look, if the Russians hack us, it's going to be very orderly.
Yeah,
that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, so it is.
We've got a fresh crop. It's the September harvest is in.
That's right.
These emails are pumpkin spice flavored. Ooh, I think
I like to have a little bit of an agrarian flair to these email episodes. I know I've said it before, I love email week just because we know what the topic's going to be.
So, this is a thing we talked about off the lines.
Yes.
A little bit.
I've got some ideas.
But I think the thing about this podcast that has become clear over the last year and change of doing it, because we're at the 1 year mark now, is that the research episodes are often very time intensive. Mm-hmm. The emails episodes are very not time intensive. It would be nice to have one more regular format. Like, even when we do interviews, they're pretty time intensive.
Yes.
Like, it would be nice to have one regular format that is not, like, somebody doing 8 hours of reading
right
before we do a recording.
Like, I had that idea about guests the other day. I was like, what if every other episode that's not the email episode was a guest episode? But you're right. Like, yeah. Getting guests is like such a moving target that's really tough to rely on.
I think once we get a pipeline of guests, it could be, but yeah, it's pretty time consuming to like think about who the guests should be, yes, and then figure out when the schedules work. Like,
booking them is a big part of the workload. But then the big one is just that life always, not always, but life can always happen. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, it turns out you have a real job. I have a job ish.
If you're, more to the point though, like your guest surely has a busy life already. And sometimes life can get in the way. And then all of a sudden you're trying to figure out what to do if they can't make
it. Yeah, and like we have a couple of guests. We have a couple of potential. We have a pretty deep well of potential incoming guests that we've engaged with and that are excited about coming on the show.
Yeah.
And either like they don't have a good place to record, or they're moving, or they're doing book tours, or you know, whatever it happens to be, it makes it challenging. So
anyway, I think we're making progress though, because we knew what this week's episode was going to be, and we know what next week's episode is going to be, which is.
Wait, what's next week's episode going to be?
I thought it was the Hitchhiker's Guide episode.
Oh, we're doing that next week. We can. Huh. Yeah, sure. Why not?
I've been reading too furiously. If we're not,
then. Like, I just told you that, so you'd hurry up and finish the damn book.
Okay, I'm getting there.
Are you enjoying?
Yeah, I'm not super deep in yet. I can't say.
I was just curious.
I'm glad I read the introduction before I started the book, so I get the Ford prefect joke, because otherwise I wouldn't have had a clue what the prefect was.
There's a lot of 70s Britishisms in there.
Yes.
But emails.
Yeah, emails. None of them were about Hitchhiker's Guide.
That's perfect.
That could be
next month.
Yeah, they're all about other stuff.
I want to hear people's stories about when they first read Hitchhiker's Guide next month.
Yes, I've seen a couple of those on the Discord already.
Me too.
All right. What's the email address? I always forget.
It is techpod@content.town. The internet's number one content destination.
That's right.
Techpod@content.town. That's right.
We have all the answers to any question you might ask. I promise. All right. Mm-hmm. First email is from Charlie. This is very timely. Extremely timely.
Huh.
I know it says something about the communities we hang out in, but I feel like this is half of all anybody's talking about right now. I don't want to talk about what the other half is.
Yeah, the other half is really a bummer. So yes. We'll get into that on the other show, The Fall of Western Civilization.
All right, here's Charlie's question. What happens on the back end when a high number of people try to order a product at the same time?
Mm.
As we've seen with the new console pre-orders and the GeForce 3080 situation, major retailers and providers of cloud services are still unable to keep things running smoothly during these high demand scenarios. Why hasn't this problem been solved yet?
It has been solved. The sneaker people figured it out years ago.
How did they?
Yeah, the sneaker situation, like you get a token, you show up at a specific time, you get a token, you use the token, you exchange the token for goods or services.
Do you mean physically show up with your token? With a physical token?
Both. Okay. I'm not a sneaker person. Yeah, I'm sure not. John Drake has a lot of information about this asked him.
Yes. I mean, obviously, going to a place, not exactly an option right now.
Like all I know is that the one time that I tried to engage with the sneaker culture business is like I logged in 5 minutes before. I made sure all my credit card stuff was into the site. I was logged in, ready to go on the right page, hit the button to refresh it, hit the button to add to cart. And by the time I clicked add to cart, it had shifted over to sold out. So
all right,
it was maybe a five. I was in limbo for maybe 8 seconds where I was like, oh, shit, I'm going to get these shoes finally. That's awesome. And then they were gone.
I mean, it may have been a failure, but at least it was a seamless or painless failure.
There was no ambiguity in that I had failed to achieve these shoes on the first pass.
You know, you just get your failure up in your face nice and early and just move on with your life.
Yeah. I could move on to not having the shoes. I transitioned directly from wanting to buy shoes to never owning the shoes.
Yes.
It was great.
I mean, obviously, like the PS5 pre-order situation was largely a failure of messaging, but the Xbox and GeForce stuff was messaged quite clearly, and those were also on fire. So it is definitely partially a back end problem. But like, is it a case of these specific retailers not dealing with these high demand situations often enough to like backstop their systems to withstand it? Like they just don't have the practice.
It's definitely. I mean, that is definitely a component. It's the same thing when we talked about I can't remember what game it was, but was it Call of Duty or something that launched and the servers just shit the bed for 5 days?
Yes, we have talked about this exact thing for game launches before.
Yeah, it's the same thing. There are multiple systems that have to talk to each other. In this case, you have the retail front end, you have the inventory back end, you have the payment processing back end. And under normal situations, the bottlenecks are not apparent.
Yeah.
And then what happens is when you get 50 million people trying to buy an Xbox at the same time, one of those systems bottlenecks, usually the credit card processing is my understanding, and the whole thing falls to shit and like everybody gets stuck in horrible limbo. The one company who's pretty good at this, it turns out, is Apple. They've been doing the online pre-orders now since like the iPhone 5. And like if you are online at the right time and you hit the right button and you know what you want, you don't dilly-dally, you usually can buy the thing that you're looking for. Sure. So
any idea who Apple's cloud compute provider is?
Apple.
Wait, do they run their own stuff?
They have data centers.
Well, yeah, for their customer facing stuff. But I mean, for their
iCloud stuff.
Like, are they really big enough in that game to provide everything they need for themselves? Like, you don't think they're doing any?
They're one of the Gamble or Google, Apple, Fang? Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook.
You're right. I just assumed, like, I mean, all I've ever heard is that AWS and Azure are so much of that market that I assumed there was no way that Apple could be providing all of their needs. Themselves.
So Apple is still small compared to AWS and Azure and all that stuff. But yeah, no. And Google. Yeah. But yeah, Apple has data centers.
They're doing it all. OK.
Yeah. There's probably teams upon teams of people because they own a credit card processing system now. Like they
that's with fair. Apple yes. Pay. That's fair.
They're soup to nuts. They're okay. Vertically integrated. You're they're right. Japanese in 1980.
You're right. I should have known that is Apple's whole thing.
Yeah.
Like I knew for, the back end, the iCloud, the once you already have the product, those services that you engage with, I knew that they were handling all that stuff themselves. But
I mean, it's entirely possible there's another payment processor in there. But at the scale that they work, it would behoove them to just not pay other people to do that work and figure it out themselves.
Of course. Another question I had looking at this was, in this future of cloud computing and like spinning up virtualized servers on demand and scaling things almost endlessly, like, do you think we could we get to a point, and especially like maybe even machine learning is involved in this in some way? I don't know. Could we get to a point where all those systems you described, payment processing, authentication, like X, Y, all the bottlenecks, could those all just be deployed by robots dynamically as the need arises and just like not run into these situations anymore?
Well, so this is the interesting part about this whole thing. This is the thing Hansa explained to me in like 2012 or 2011 when something broke.
I miss getting drunk with Hanzo. He was just one of the smartest people I have ever hung out with.
Yeah, I mean, don't play German board games with him. He just holds the whole state of the game in his head. But we would. He was explaining why that similar situation failed. He's like, look, there's some stuff that you can't like. You can spin up infinite web servers to deliver web pages, right? And that is, there's a tool that does that for you. And the workload for that is really easy. But what you can't do is spin up multiple load balancers because you need to have one giant beefy load balancer. You can't have multiple copies of a database server because then the databases get out of sync and bad things happen. So like, if the bottleneck is the front end going to the inventory to see if the thing is in stock before they transfer to the payment processor, you can't have like there's bad things happen if the inventory system gets out of sync with the if multiple nodes of the inventory system get out of sync. So the reason this stuff still happens is that it's hard to fake those workloads. Like you can fake a normal workload pretty easily with a few hundred machines and spinning up VMs to do unit testing and stuff like that, but it's pretty expensive to spin up 30,000 instances and hit, 30,000 fake, a massive scale all landing at one time.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Mystery solved.
It's probably cheaper to just deal with the aftermath than to harden your system against that.
Yeah.
Or alternately, each time you have that kind of sales system, you log it and you see what happens and you see see how to do it better next time. But sometimes it's something stupid, like maybe the load balancer has logging turned on and that then you get gated by how fast you can write to the disks, write that log to the disks. So
it sucks to say this, and I am by no means defending this mess, but it's not like all the people who feel like they got screwed trying to get a 3080 suddenly want a 3080 less because of the experience. So
yeah.
I can see why the NVIDIAs and
look, it's Sony's not as bad
of the world would just kind of sail right through and keep going.
it's not as bad as when and at the end of the day, this is about consumer electronics, not like vital things. Yeah. It's not like, you know, when you had 10 days to sign up for insurance under the Affordable Care Act and that site just didn't work for any of those 10 days.
Yes.
That it turned out was bad.
Yes, that's for sure. Also, actually, like what I just said was not totally fair to NVIDIA and Sony, because both of them actually came out pretty publicly and apologized for the situation in the last week or two.
I feel like this is the second generation of console stuff, specifically that like the hardware vendors released the hardware and it was unclear whether they like you couldn't tell if they thought there was going to be a market for it. Right.
Yes.
Like I remember on the PS4, Xbox One generation, people were like, I don't know if people are going to buy these. Phones are really popular, it turns out. And yeah. And then here we are.
Yeah.
100 million consoles later.
Yeah.
200 million consoles.
Actually, later. I mean, I don't want to spend the whole episode on this topic or this question, but did you read the fact that NVIDIA put up? They actually... Like Sony just tweeted, which for a company like Sony that I understand is like kind of momentous in its own right that they even said anything. But they just posted a tweet saying like, hey, sorry, this definitely could have gone better. We will have more stock soon. But NVIDIA straight up put up a whole webpage on their site. GeForce RTX 3080 launch. What happened? You asked, we answered.
And oh, that's cool.
It's a full on fact of launch has made it near impossible to find one. And this is really disappointing. What happened? What's the overall stock situation? Why do you start with such low inventory? Why not wait until more cards are produced? What changes are you making on your store? Like, I'm searching here for bots. Yes, there are multiple references to bots in this FAQ.
So the other thing that has happened, and that's a good point, I forgot about that, is the sneaker bots have been weaponized against this kind of electronic good too, because it's a scalping situation. Like you can buy a 3080 and then turn it around on eBay for 200, 300, 400, 500 bucks more.
Yes.
And, you know, make a pretty good amount of money doing that. I completely lost my thought there.
It's okay. I can fill time. By saying that, you look stone-faced all of a sudden.
Shit.
Yeah,
it's totally gone.
I get it. I've been there.
It was important, too.
Mental short circuit occurs. Something broke in there. I know how it goes.
It was Bitcoin. Oh. We don't have this question in the queue, I don't think, but somebody had asked if this is because Bitcoin miners or cryptocurrency miners are scooping up all the high-end GPUs. And the shift, A, people don't mine Bitcoin with GPUs really anymore. They use specialized ASICs.
Right.
But B, the miners are going for... like compute units per watt, and the high end video cards that are optimized for cycles per watt cycles per clock are not particularly good for that. You're much better off buying a less expensive card that uses less power, but has a equally wide compute pipeline. So they'll be looking at 3070s and maybe even 3060s.
Interesting.
Especially early on, because the mining tools aren't optimized for the new GDDR memory and stuff like that. You may even see like, you may be better off running on a 1060 or a 2060 than a 3090, even is the thing I read. So
that's good news. Good news for people wanting to get a hold of one of these. I'll mention real fast in this fact, NVIDIA says they canceled a bunch of orders placed by bots after the fact.
Oh, good. That's probably where the extra excess new inventories come from.
Those did not ship, according to them. So that's something.
I mean, honestly, given what happened in China and the state of the pandemic and stuff like that, it's amazing to me that any of this stuff has launched.
Yes. Yes. I'm with you. Also, like, I don't know how much it matters, but that card is on a new process for them. The Samsung 8-nanometer, they have not been on before.
New foundry
so
too.
Like that, yeah. That, yeah. So that may have constrained supply somewhat as well.
It's funny. I could be wrong on this, but I can't remember a time that NVIDIA wasn't building chips on TSMC's foundries. Yeah. So it's interesting that they moved to Samsung for this.
I really want one of those cards. Like I'm on a GTX 1080 regular, not TI, since I don't even know how long, 4 years ago. And I have felt zero compunction to upgrade until right now. And all of a sudden,
well, the bad news for you and the good news for everybody else who wants to spend money to get a card is that there are, as I understand it, the reviewers got cards and influencers and everybody else is behind the people that are paying cash money for hardware.
That is my understanding. That's fun.
Yeah.
Also, I've got these 1440p monitors right now. It's a lot more pixels to drive.
Uh-huh.
Suddenly the 1080 is feeling a little more long in the tooth.
Uh-huh.
All right. We should move on to the next email. Pierce from Marquette, Michigan. You mentioned in a previous podcast that everyone should have a headlamp. I would add everyone should have one that also has a red light mode as well.
Yes.
Yeah, it's and I've actually got some experience with this recently also that I wanted to ask about. It's very handy for not blowing out your pupils late at night when you need to use it to find something or in very specific use cases. For example, using it in the car while driving. A few years back, my wife was studying for a college course and needed to read her textbook while we were traveling in the car. She was able to do this by turning on the red LED light on her headlamp. I was not affected and could still see everything around me just fine while driving, and she could read her book. Though making out her highlighting was a tad bit difficult. So
don't use the red highlighter there. Yeah. Yes.
So like I only recently became aware of this in the last year or two that
you didn't know. You're not into astronomy. Did you do college? No,
sadly no. But yeah, I didn't really realize that red light, I guess, is the only wavelength that won't totally destroy your night vision.
Yeah, I don't know why that is. My bet is it's a rods and cones thing. Okay. Right?
Yeah. Well, bummer. That's what I came in here to ask was why that is. Is that true of everything? Like not even orange light? Because like orange is typically like, you know, once the Apple Night Shift and the, well, God, what was the original version of that? The third party?
Flux.
Flux, right. I feel terrible about that because like Flux started that whole trend and then.
Well, Flux got Sherlocked.
Everybody implemented their own at the OS level and now Flux has been forgotten. That sucks.
Well, Flux is still really good. Flux, if you have like Hue bulbs, will sync up your bulbs in your house to the Flux. You could Flux your house, yo.
Flux lives on.
But so that's a different thing. That's a different effect.
I know it is. Yeah. I know why that happens, but I was wondering if there was any overlap there where like orange light was also better at night, or is that still too close to daylight to be useful?
I don't know.
The reason I ask all this is I have an LED color changing nightlight.
Okay.
In the bedroom.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those, like, at least in the Apple Home, you can just slide it's got a color wheel. It's full on 16.7 million colors or whatever it is. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it doesn't actually reproduce all those, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
I had it on orange for the longest time. Well, actually I had it on green for a long time. I don't know why. And then I was like, that's probably too close to blue to be looking at in the middle of the night when I wake up to go to the bathroom. And then I moved it to orange. And then I thought like maybe even orange is too close to daylight. This was once I, you know, found out about the red stuff being the best for night. So I changed it to red, which is great for not ruining my night vision. But it kind of is not bright enough, even at full brightness, to really see.
Well, so I used the red flashlight when we went out to look at the Perseids a few weeks ago. And it only is useful when your eyes are fully adjusted.
Okay.
Like it's part of the reason this worked for him in the car is that when he was looking, when other headlights were shining at him and stuff like that, his eyes were adjusting for the headlights and then snapping right back. He probably could barely see the red light when he was looking at the road and the lights and the street lights and stuff like that would be my guess.
Yeah.
But as long as she was looking down, it was fine.
Yeah. I'm sure like even your own headlights are constricting your pupils probably, at least somewhat, right?
I would think so. Yeah. I mean, compared to like your full dilated, you know, I've been out in a cave for the last 3 days. Look, it's probably that. It's funny. I took an astronomy class in high school at the local college, and that was when I was introduced to the red light magic because the astronomers all had, like, at that point, they had just normal incandescent flashlights. So they put a piece of red cellophane over the cone and would use those like little mag lights that had rubber banded cellophane on them. And it was really useful.
Do you think when you wake up in the middle of the night randomly, are your eyes fully dilated before you open your eyes? I mean, your pupils fully dilated?
So. Like that I can always see really well.
Like, I wonder if you have to be in any degree of conscious for that to fully happen.
I would think that's an autonomous thing.
Yeah, I would too.
If only we had medical professionals handy to ask this sort of thing.
Yeah, like I'd not to get too much into a cognitive rabbit hole here, but I wonder what even controls that action.
Oh, that's definitely autonomic. You don't have any control over that. Yeah.
Oh no, I know you don't. I'm saying what are the mechanics of making that happen? Like, is that some part of the lizard brain or?
Brad, I got just the guest for this. We got to get him on. Okay. We got to work the schedule. I got your guy for this one.
I got to write these questions down. Is there a term for something that happens without the involvement of the brain whatsoever? Like if the mechanics are entirely somehow like controlled by the organ itself? Does that make sense? I don't know if this is an example of that.
Well, like the heart is self-regulating. There's nodes in the heart that stimulate the muscle fibers in the heart.
Right.
But I don't know. I can't remember if there's some autonomic, I feel like there's two systems there. One that makes the beats go based on the flow of blood through the heart. And then the limbic system, I guess, autonomic nervous system that keeps the heart going, period. But it's been a long time since I've studied any of this stuff. And probably what I know is 20 years out of date.
Yes, we are definitely out of our depth here.
Yeah, this is a scary conversation. Yeah. I expect usually we get yelled at by the business people, but this time it's going to be the science people.
Yes. Anyway, I don't know why that red night light is not really enough to see very well at night. So I might have to go back to the orange.
Well, it's because your eyes aren't adjusted.
Well, that's why I was asking, do you think they're fully dilated when you wake up?
One of the other things that happens as we get older is night vision gets worse.
Oh, don't say that. Don't say that.
I'm sorry. I got bad news.
All right.
You've got let me tell you, going out stargazing with a 7-year-old. It is
an eye opening experience.
Yeah. She's like, hey, there's a raccoon over there. I was like, there's no raccoon over there. And then I hear the skittering. She's like, no, there's a raccoon over there. I need to eat more carrots.
Yes. I've already been told that I am an early candidate for bifocals, so I don't need to hear any more about my vision deteriorating.
just you know, you can also get longer arms if you need to. That's the other way to do it. Yeah. Just hold that reading stuff further out.
Start hanging out on the monkey bars more. Okay. Let's see. Quick question from Jonathan. If you want a small, cheap network rack, IKEA LAC tables are exactly the right size to put rack mount switches into. I wouldn't put anything heavy in, but if it's just for a cupboard and a 24 port switch, they totally work. I don't know if this came up on the Discord or somewhere, but I had seen this going around somewhere else recently. Also, we used to have a couple of LACs around here that we just kind of gave away on the sidewalk, which makes me really sad now.
Potential LAC rack.
I know, a LAC rack would be pretty awesome.
I feel like you'd have to
drill into together. It or something. Yeah.
You have to drill for sure.
Yeah.
You can also get a quarter or a half rack for like $80 on Amazon. It seems like I don't think most normal human beings want a full 8-footer, right? Like you want, what is that? A 48U?
I do.
You want like a 12U.
I want a rack that I can stand in.
Well, I mean,
I don't have a good reason for it.
It's just really heavy. Your floor isn't rated for it. Probably if you filled that thing with computers,
I'd never do it in an apartment. Yeah, that's insanity.
Sag the building.
That is, stand up racks are for a cement floor basement and nothing else.
Yeah,
that's my stance. Anyway, that's a pretty hot tip.
I like that. I mean, you could have a little side table over here with a rack. I'm increasingly on the let's rack mount everything in the office train. My switch is rack mountable.
Heck yeah.
Put the streaming computer rack mount.
Just get it all out of sight.
I told you about my water heatsink idea, right?
Yes.
Just put a bucket of cold water in here at the start of the night
and rack, just throw that
dump
in the rack.
All the heat from the computer in there.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. I have been looking at 10 gigabit network equipment again. So,
oh no,
I might need a rack size switch at some point. That's way down the line.
What kind of files are you transferring over there, man?
Well, actually right now, I mean, since we're doing everything at home, like I am recording 30 to 40 gigabyte videos on a near daily basis.
Oh shit.
Since I'm archiving.
Yeah, so 10 gigabit makes sense.
Yeah. Like I'm archiving everything at 30 megabit right now.
Wow.
So yeah, like the Mario 2 stream we did yesterday was over 30 gig when we finished. Like files of that size take a little bit of time to move around.
Hold on. Just to be clear, you're playing a 240 vertical line resolution game.
Man, don't nitpick.
And you're recording it at.
Don't nitpick my workflow, please. Don't forget these files are going straight through another round of compression after we record them.
Yeah.
So they need to be high quality the first time, immediately going to get crunched down to like 8 megabit again. And if they like, that's the thing, we were pulling like Twitch archives, which are already 8 megabit, and throwing them through that encoder again. That doesn't look very good.
No. Twitch archives are like Twitch and YouTube archives are not an acceptable archiving medium.
Right. That's what I'm saying
for sure.
So like we need a high quality version to throw into our video robot,
man,
to crunch it down again. Anyway. I probably wouldn't get a switch. I would just get two 10 gig cards, one in my PC, one in my NAS, and just do a direct connection.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it would be fun. Let's see here.
Is there a question in there?
No, it's just a little tip.
Okay.
The LAC is just happens to be the exact right size.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Yeah. Question from Justin. how do I get my Windows audio to automatically switch from my computer speakers to my TV HDMI when I turn it on?
That's impossible. You can't do it.
Windows audio device juggling is terrible and always has been.
Well, hold on. You can do that if you leave it plugged in all the time and you set the HDMI on the TV as the primary by turning it when it's on.
Sure.
And then when you plug in the TV or turn on the TV ever, even if it's not you doing it, it will switch.
Yes.
It should.
Yes.
That's what it's supposed to do.
Yeah. Which is great right up until the first time it happens and you don't want it to.
Yeah.
When somebody else turns the TV on.
Watching something untoward and say a partner turns on the TV in the other room and all of a sudden there's strange noises coming from it.
That's not exactly where my mind went with that, but sure, that's also undesirable.
Look, I'm talking about buying gifts for your partner in incognito mode.
Yes.
Gifts.
Yes. Yes. If you're watching a YouTube review of that cutlery set and you don't want to give away the surprise.
Yeah. Or you're watching some anime and people are really excited.
Yeah. Or just gotten way down a VTuber hole and you don't want anybody to know what you're up to.
Yeah. I got no beef with the VTubers.
Yeah. Let's see if I can manage to include a VTuber thumbnail on both podcasts that I edit this week.
There was some conversation about this week on the Discord.
It's attention getting.
People love their VTubers.
They sure do.
We have some friends who do some light VTuber stuff.
Whatever, I know that. Fuck that, man. I was VTubing 5 years ago.
How are you VTubing 5 years ago?
I full on used Face Rig on a UPF in 2015.
Wow.
To
you were a thought leader.
Sub myself in.
THOTT. You could have been huge in Japan, Korea, China.
Yes. I missed my calling.
Missed opportunity.
As usual. There might be some third party solutions out there to make the audio device switching a little better in Windows, but it's not amazing. It's better than it used to be. Actually.
I feel like there's a command line script. Like there's that NearSoft tool.
Oh, yeah. NearSoft always to the rescue. NearSoft definitely. In fact, I use NearSoft utility to do exactly that, but like that's not quite. He's asking for automatic switching back and forth intelligently, and it doesn't.
See,
like even in my use case with that NearSoft, I still have to like click a shortcut every time I want to change a device and stuff like that.
Well, so you can do task scheduler and have it watch for a particular event ID
that's
that device connecting, and then fire the NearSoft task on that. But my guess is it's not going to work very well, and it's going to be really fucking annoying.
Knowing Windows, that's probably not very reliable, and probably more work than you want to do. It's just kind of a mess. Let's see here. Actually, I didn't even realize we have two PC audio questions this week, so I'll just do the other one. This is from Jack. Ooh. If you have speakers hooked up to your computer and they have a volume knob on them, but your keyboard also has volume keys, which do you use, the software volume control or the hardware? I've always opted for the hardware knob, but my sneakers, I think he meant speakers here. But my speakers on my desk will be behind monitors now, so I'm going to have to try and retrain my whole situation. Do you have strong feelings about this?
I set the hardware knob at 50%.
And then never touch it?
Never touch it.
Oh my God, that is... I'm a little more flexible these days, but that is the exact opposite of where I used to be. Like way back in the day, like 20 years ago or whatever. Like I was full on hardware knob and nothing else. I didn't want to touch any of the volume sliders on the PC for any reason if I could help it. I don't know why. But like application specific volume controls or even like the slider in Windows or whatever, just like, no, thank you. I wanted a consistent volume out of the source and just be able to change it to the hardware level.
So that's what I used to do, I guess. And since I started streaming more, getting the audio levels right is more impactful to other human beings and not just me.
Yes, I think that's what broke me of that habit is at some point, if you're trying to stream, you're trying to send one type of audio out to people on your Discord and like another one to the stream you're doing. And like you're trying to maybe record yet another volume. Like at some point you have to give in and just fiddle volume anywhere you can.
Yeah, exactly. I also have studio monitors on my desk and haven't had an easy volume knob on them in like 5 years. So when I got rid of the Klipsches, the volume knob went away. So that kind of solved the problem for me.
You will take my Cambridge Soundworks cubes from my cold dead hands. So I will always have
a lifetime
knob.
Supply.
That's right
now.
I will always have a volume knob. Use the software ones too. That's what they're there for. All right.
I think we might have gotten a little bit of my daughter in that last question, so I apologize. That's
okay. I didn't hear anything. Yeah. Using any of the RTX, mess with that broadcast app. I should probably save that for another week. But
so the broadcast app, this question is from Brad. Hey, have you messed with that broadcast app at all? It doesn't really work for me because I do 2PC streaming. Right.
Okay. And yeah, and it's spitting out virtual devices, so you need it to be on the same machine as the streaming is happening on.
Theoretically, so I don't have an RTX card in the streaming machine because I don't need one there. I could theoretically run it there, and it would be nice maybe to filter Discord, because a lot of times you play games with people who have clacky keyboards. It would be dope to take out the clackiness from their feed. But it doesn't, because of the way I use the hardware mixer, it makes everything way more complicated. And I don't think there's an easy way to do that, because it runs, the Discord feed runs into VoiceMeeter and then across an ASIO bus to the mixer where it gets mixed in and then goes straight to OBS. So there's no place for me to filter it out, really.
It's fair.
Yeah,
that is fair. If and when I get my hands on an RTX card, I am excited to try that stuff out. Especially because I got this super nice new mirrorless camera, which already does nice depth of field optically.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that, I mean, it seems like that RTX fake green, or, you know, programmatic green screen feature works very well anyway, but I'm assuming if you've got a camera that focuses very well on the foreground and blurs the background, it'll be even better.
You shouldn't, but I mean, since you have the camera that blurs the background, you shouldn't need because remember, there's performance hit on that stuff. You don't want to take a 10% performance hit on blurring the background when you have a lens that does that on your camera already.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about blurring the background. I'm talking about removing it.
Well, same thing.
You
want to green screen it?
Yes, I want just a cutout of me in the foreground with no background.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah, I'm excited to try that stuff out.
It's funny because all the Twitch kids are all about having cool backgrounds.
So a lot of people do that cutout now. Like, I feel like a lot of the bigger Twitch feeds I look at.
Like, in the 3 years that I've been streaming, it started out as everybody green screening, and then everybody went to the big room, and now the wave is starting to turn back, it seems.
Don't get me wrong, if I can sub stupid animated backgrounds in instead of cutting myself out, keying myself out or whatever, I will absolutely lead in that direction.
Don't do static. H.264 does not like static, it turns out.
I will hang out in front of the Weather Channel all day long.
Yeah. That Good Place background. Everything's fine.
That's right. At least it's fine somewhere.
In hell.
Let's see. How about this one? Tom from Cape Cod.
Okay.
I wanted to get your thoughts on the arc of industrial design of phones and other consumer tech products, specifically Apple's iPhone and AirPod line. I've never understood the move towards a design prioritizing rounded edges and all glass that seems incapable of being held reliably by the human hand and prone to sliding effortlessly from your pocket. Likewise, the smooth rounded edges of my AirPods case seem to be tailor-made to slip out of the pockets of my scrubs while driving or off the edge of shelves and desks. So I wanted to hear your thoughts on this drive towards form over function that ultimately ends up being somewhat or mostly concealed by some form of protective case anyway. I loved the early days with my Droid and iPhone 4, where I could safely carry my phone naked as the day it was born, unencumbered by a protective case.
I miss the plastic back phones.
Really?
Huh. Yeah.
Interesting.
Well,
just for the ruggedness.
So my daughter was born in 2013. Starting about 2015, I always had to have a case on the phone because I smashed two iPhones within about 2 weeks of each other.
That hurts.
It was expensive.
Yeah, that hurts.
I mean, I didn't smash them. I had help.
Yes, but of course.
The point is they were equally destroyed.
Yeah.
I feel like the post iPhone 4 design was designed to move cases.
Think so?
Or AppleCare.
Yeah. Well,
have to be a maniac to not buy AppleCare on a phone with a glass back.
Yeah, totally. So the 4 had a glass back, did it not? I'm pretty sure it did. The 4 did, the 5 did not.
I'm saying anything from the 4 on. Yeah.
I think the 5 was all metal. And then, actually, so was the 6.
The 5 had a partial glass back. Everything else after that has been glass.
It was that little strip at the top that was glass, right?
The top and I think that was for
antenna purposes. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's why they're on glass now, right? It was mostly antenna stuff. And but wireless
plastic
charging
is just as transparent and wireless as plastic.
Yeah,
as
glass. I'm with you. I wish they would just come up with some high-end Italian plastic that Apple could be happy with.
Look, this is very much like the design goal with, first off, scrubs have terrible pockets. I've never worn a pair. I've only worn scrubs a handful of times. The pockets suck. Yeah. They're always too shallow and shit falls out of them. So
there's that.
There's that. B, I think that part of this is Johnny Ive's bullshit about making things thinner and shinier and making them feel expensive, even if they're not.
And more rounded.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the rounded is an old school Apple thing that's been around. Like they always did rounded icons and stuff like that.
I'll just say it right now. I never owned an iPhone 4, but the 4 and the 5, which I did own, I think are my favorite iPhones still.
The 5 is probably my favorite iPhone at this point.
Might be my favorite iPhone. I mean, the chamfered edges were a little weird, you know, the triangular kind of slanted shape.
There's a straight through line from the 4 and the 5 to the 10, though.
Like I've got my 5 right here. The screen is flat.
What a beaut.
Nice, just nice hard edge. It's easy to swipe all the way to the edge of the screen. It stands up. Like you can't see it in the camera, but literally
standing up is really good.
Literally stands up on its edge. I've got it sitting here standing up on its side right now. I would
put it on the tray in front of me and just balance it on the barely pulled out plane tray.
So do you know how starting with the 6, they're glass, and I've got an 8 right here, which you can maybe kind of see. Like the glass went to rounded.
Yep.
Starting with the 6, I have always had a hard time swiping to the far edge of the UI because of that stupid rounded edge, and I hate it.
Well, so the 6 also had the new borosilicate glass and the curves. The 6 was the one I broke 2 of, and I'm pretty sure it was because those curves are incredible stress points. So any kind of impact on the curve, the corner curve, seemed to smash them.
Yeah.
I feel like the chamfered edges on the aluminum were really good.
Yeah.
I would say all modern phones, with a handful of exceptions, are designed to have cases, and that's just a cost of doing business.
Yeah, I suppose so.
I mean, we also the thing to remember is in that time, I mean, the iPhone was expensive when it launched, but we've gone from phones that they expected you to upgrade every year to I'm into my third year, I think, on my iPhone 10, and it's just now starting to kind of chug a little bit. So I feel like, you know, buy a case.
Yes.
I'm on my second case for this phone, actually. I wore the first one out, the leather one that I got at first. So
case I'm using on this 8 is billed as the world's thinnest case.
Yep.
In fact, I feel like calling it a case is very generous.
Those don't do anything to protect the phone from drops. It's just scratches. No,
it's just scratches. I only got it. I got it because it has a glass back and I wanted to not scratch that up to make sure the resale value hung around a bit.
Well, the nice thing about the thin cases on the glass back is if you smash the back, it doesn't matter because you'll never know until you take the case off when you're ready to sell it.
And it does give a nice textured grip that makes it a little easier to.
Yeah.
And does not increase the bulk of the phone. Anyway, it's totally understandable, but they sure are late with the iPhone announcement for the year. But all those rumors all those rumors about the iPhone 12 going back to the 4 or 5 era design language are very, very exciting to me.
This is the first time in a while that we don't kind of know what the phone's going to look like yet.
Yeah.
Usually there's rumors by this point.
There are some renders out there. You can find some stuff.
There's always renders, but are they actual, typically the case manufacturers will have leaked blanks and stuff that by now.
I wonder if just the pandemic is just making it harder for leakers to get their hands on that information.
I would bet that there are way fewer people actually touching the things across all types of these markets.
Yeah. I think the latest rumors I saw said announcement early October. So that's probably just a couple weeks, 3 weeks off maybe.
I mean, so the only thing that makes me excited about those dual screen phones is that then you have something that the clamshell closes up, you put it in your pocket and it's all the delicate bits are protected.
God, we're just back to flip phones again, aren't we?
I mean, you can buy a Razor right now.
Just everything just wraps back around eventually.
Pretty soon.
Yes.
That joke in Zoolander about how small the phone is will make sense to the next generation of children.
Indeed.
Also, don't watch Zoolander, maybe.
All right. A couple more emails real quick before we get out of here. This one is from Tom in Toronto. So a couple of more socially minded topics here around tech. Around April, I decided to learn how to program. I've done random coding and scripting over the years, but most of the time I didn't really understand what I was doing and just copied and pasted random stuff from Stack Overflow. A literal script kitty. Also, I'm approaching 40 and maybe this is my midlife crisis, but the good news is that it's been great at keeping my mind occupied and has been incredibly rewarding. It's obviously intimidating and daunting to start out at my age, and considering I could barely remember high school math, I thought there was a good chance I wouldn't actually be able to do it. But since April, I've learned enough C to be somewhat dangerous and enough Python to already consider other languages inferior. I've learned a ton, and maybe I just happen to fall into decent communities, including your own, but people have been incredibly helpful and supportive. With that long self-congratulatory preamble over, One thing that keeps popping into my head is the thought that a lot of the work programmers do may not be very ethical. I don't just mean programmers and engineers that write something illicit so that a car passes an emissions test. I mean the run-of-the-mill work done within a lot of companies. How many people do programmers put out of work each year? OpenAI has only been around for 5 years, and GPT has only been around since 2018. Where will they be in 2030? I also don't hear a lot of politicians and lawmakers addressing this sort of thing. Generally, when anything related to technology comes up in front of government leaders, it's embarrassing. I don't think most countries have any sort of programmers' labor organization like engineers may have, or the same level of just cultures where this sort of thing might be addressed. I'm guessing this must be discussed in academics, but from the outside, a lot of the general organization seems insanely fragmented and heavily corporate. Do you know of any leaders out there talking about this sort of thing intelligently? Does any of this worry you as much as it does me? Will shook his head and then nodded his head. I think I'm with you on all of that.
Yeah. Everything he said is right.
Yes. Like, I mean, whatever. I mean, that's such a broad topic. You know, the idea of automation displacing people's livelihoods becomes more and more urgent every day.
I
don't know how much stock you put in this, but the one I always see floated as the nightmare scenario is the idea of the end of human operated long haul trucking.
Yeah, that seems like it would take a boatload of jobs, huh?
Yes, and how many people that will put out of work, and or more to the point, how close that might be. I mean, that's the part where maybe it breaks down, is maybe like people always think things like self-driving are a lot closer than they actually are. Maybe that's 30 or 40 years away instead of 10, but like that's the one I keep saying. Or I keep seeing people saying is like, oh, that's the one that may actually happen and cause this massive, massive disruption.
So I talked to an economist friend about the idea of automation killing jobs years ago.
Or, you know, in this case, we can also roll like AI killing jobs, you know.
Yeah, same thing. AI is replacing brain jobs. Yes, automation is replacing manual, physical jobs.
Yeah.
And he said that every time this has happened in the past, starting with like the invention of the cotton mill or cotton gin and the Industrial Revolution and all of that stuff, every time there's been a technological advance that reduced the amount of labor that goes into previous jobs, the result of that labor going away was always more jobs.
Hmm.
Because you know, if all the blogging in the example we were talking about was AI machine learning algorithms writing blog posts, because that's been like if you recall, there was a thing in like 2013 that they had a bad ML algorithm that could kind of generate a blog post off of a press release pretty easily. And the thing that he said in that example was, hey, probably the people that are doing those jobs now will find other jobs either picking the press releases that go into the generator, so their output goes way up. So instead of writing $5, $10 blog posts a day, they'll write $50, $10 blog posts a day. So there'll be way more content, which is a whole other problem. Or there'll be other jobs, you know, training the algorithms to work better or something like that. It's always scary. Yeah. I think when we think about automation replacing people's jobs, but It's the fossil fuel thing is kind of an interesting place. Like, yeah, we've lost a bunch of coal jobs. We've lost a bunch of natural gas jobs. I mean, actually, we haven't lost that many natural gas jobs because fracking is way up. But the point is, we've lost fossil fuel jobs. And at the same time, the number of environmentally friendly power generation jobs have multiplied dramatically.
Yeah.
Are there as many of those as there were oil drilling jobs 50 years ago? Probably not. But there aren't as many oil drilling jobs as there were 50 years ago either.
Sure.
Because that whole industry has gotten pretty automated. Anyway.
Yeah, I believe what your friend is saying on a long enough time scale. Of course, society is going to adapt. Like the problem is in the short term, how much pain and uncertainty does that create for the specific individuals being displaced?
Yeah.
Like obviously people who are kids now, once they come up and those jobs are no longer there, they will find something else to do because they've never had to find something to do in the first place before.
Like clean water distiller will be a job when our kids are kids are looking for jobs. They'll have to, you know, go out and moisture farm so that we have fresh water to drink.
But you know, for the people that have built an entire life and career out of or around something that suddenly is not there anymore, like that is significantly more problematic than it is for future generations. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't cotton to the idea that progress should be held back because it will put people out of work.
Because, you can't do that. It doesn't work. We've tried that before.
Yeah, not only that, but also like that, you know, you could follow that logic to say like we shouldn't pursue green energy because it will put fossil fuel workers out of a job. Like that's obviously not tenable either. But like that just places even more of an onus on political leaders to take care of those people and ease the transition and make sure that they are not left destitute or helpless. Right. But unfortunately, it just feels like the will is never there at the political level to actually like pad those sorts
in the US.
Of, yeah, especially here.
The other side of this is the ethics of programming. And I think that people are starting to think about that much more now. If you look at the impact of things like Facebook and election interference and you know, places where like if you contribute to the algorithm that determines what news people see on Facebook, are you culpable in the damage that Facebook has done to Western democracies? I'm not in a position to say yes or no, but I wouldn't want to do that job probably.
No.
And I think people have to decide whether, you know, a lot of good perks and a nice salary is worth contributing to that on an individual basis. Yeah. It would be nice if like the American Society of Engineers, the different engineering societies, like there's chemical engineering societies, there's civil engineer societies, stuff like that, do kind of fill this hole for engineering, you know, people who are engineers, not software engineers. And I feel like we don't have that kind of infrastructure around software engineers, partly because of the kind of shaming of unions for white collar workers for a long time. Not that those societies are necessarily like typical labor unions, but they do have some of the same purposes and we would all be better off if more people were thinking about what the long-term ramifications of their work and actions were.
Yes. Yes. You're totally right. There is no stopping the march of progress, even if you want to, right? The answer is just, you need more representation, more, more robust social safety net, more regulatory action to try to funnel it in a positive direction and not a negative one.
Well, and the other thing to do, the thing to do is to look at what freeing up all of this labor, like it's like automated, it's like industrial farming. You know, when we industrialized farming in the 60s in the US, all of a sudden we had a ton of brains that could essentially be used for other things. So like little Jimmy didn't have to go work on Papa's farm doing the chickens every day, and he could go to college and get a degree and be an accountant or an engineer or a software programmer or whatever. And each time that's happened, the workforce has shifted generationally. But you're right. We do have to like help the people who are pushed out of old jobs.
Yeah,
whether it's bloggers or farmers or coal miners.
Somebody's always going to get left behind.
Yeah, Kirk Cameron. Fuck that guy.
All right. Last email.
Hot takes here.
Yes.
Sorry.
Last email. this one came in anonymously.
Oh.
There's a lot of talk in tech communities about new things. It's the nature of the beast, but there is no escaping that new things cost money and mean old things get phased out or thrown away. Companies don't get to make cool new things unless people buy them, but often the changes are small and old things still work well. There's an undercurrent of wanton consumerism to tech that prevents a lot of people from engaging with it and can be a little crass when people dismiss what was amazing a few years ago as crap, or unplayable, or unwatchable, or unlistenable. Everyone is different and can do what they want with their money, so I definitely don't want to start drawing lines or making examples. But I wanted to ask you two, how long do you consider value in tech? I'm sorry, I misread that. How do you consider value in tech when you're shopping? Do you have to have a definite purpose or want something to last a minimum amount of time? I know it might be a bit different with work-related things. But how do you feel about the consumerist angle that drives a lot of tech hobbyism and whether there is a way to lower the barrier of entry for some of this stuff? Do you get a kick out of doing something on the cheap nearly as well and saving some money? I will answer that last question first. Yes, absolutely. Like,
yeah, 100%.
I 1000% get way more gratification out of doing something like, you know, on a wish and a wing and a prayer or whatever, you know. Like some bootstrapped cheap solution rather than like spending the big money and getting the nice thing. I will always rather put my own solution together for something like that.
Oh, well, but it's tricky. That can be tricky too, right? Like I'm having router problems as predicated by our conversation a few months ago.
Fancy router is calling.
fuck, I don't want a fancy router. Anyway, the point is, I was looking at building a pfSense router with hardware that I have laying around. And when I figured out what the power would cost to run the pfSense hardware with the hardware I have laying around, I was like, it literally makes more sense for me to spend $180 on an edge router that's going to draw infinitely less power than to try to like jury rig something together with parts that I have just floating.
There are always going to be considerations. I don't mean it's not always a one size fits all, just use your old stuff constantly kind of situation, but
yeah, no, but yeah, like this is a thing I've struggled with. I've been in and out of this business for 20 years. And it's one of the things that when Norm and I started tested, we talked about a lot because, you know, at Maximum PC, the brand that I walked into and became part of and didn't have anything to do with forming was performance at all costs, which in the 90s made sense, right? Like the jump from a Pentium 3 to a Pentium 4 was enormous. And if you were using that computer for work or for play, you know, like you could spend money on a new piece. Also, the hardware was a lot cheaper. You'd spend $500 on a new CPU and it would have a marked improvement in either your enjoyment of your hobby or your day-to-day work life. You could get more work done. You know, if you're a photographer or a video editor, getting more work done on that machine meant you were making more money, which is presumably good. The thing that changed is that the performance increases generationally started to decrease. Like you go from a 30 or 40 or 50% performance boost in some cases to a 5 or 10% performance in a more incremental upgrade. And at that point, no, you shouldn't upgrade for a 10% boost unless there is a measurable impact. Right. So when we started testing, we wanted to balance that out. And we started thinking about, you know, when you're buying phones, you're buying a phone for at least a year or two. Normal people should be buying a phone for at least 2 years because that's what the contract terms were at the time.
Even 2 years to me sounds pretty woefully short. Like I'm kind of on the same page as this emailer to some degree, like in a perfect world. And granted, we're not really there, like in a world where Android and iOS updates are coming out that make old phones run like garbage and they are actually getting worse over time instead of just staying static. Like it's not feasible, but like ideally I would like to be able to get like 5 years or more out of a phone because
the phone's a weird case, right? Because the batteries are good for usually about 1500 cycles and they're relatively easy to replace.
Like,
now
that's assuming like, oh, you might have to go get at least one, if maybe not two, battery replacements in that time.
But also, like, I do kind of subscribe to the Brian Lamb, who started Wirecutter and is a longtime friend and one of the editors of Gizmodo for a long time, has posted a thing years ago that I think about every time it's time to look at new iPhones, which is that's his primary computer. And like you and I sit in front of desktop computers most of the day, and it's not our primary computer. But if your work or your life is such that like that phone is your day to day, the main way that you connect with the digital world, I can kind of see upgrading it every year, every 2 years.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't find that particularly offensive. Same thing. Like Gina, we have Gina on the upgrade plan for the phones because like it's literally the main camera for the house at this point, and she takes pictures of our kid and our family doing stuff.
That's fair.
But also at the same time, the performance jump between my iPhone 10 and her iPhone 11 is such that like there's a marked difference in the quality of the photos she takes and
right.
I take.
Yeah. Like phones, mobile devices are now where the PCs were 20, 25 years ago. Right. Like,
yeah. Well, I think the phones are actually now at the point where the PCs were 10 years ago.
So they're starting to hit that plateau, right?
I think we're at that point of diminishing returns. If you buy a $1,000 phone this year, you're probably good for 3 years at least, and probably five if you especially if you are careful about upgrading software when you get toward the end of that cycle.
Right. Like this is actually the reason it's been a couple months, I think, or more that I was talking about replacing this iPhone 8 with an SE. Like it's the same form factor, the same screen. Like my hands-on experience with this phone will not change one iota if I get an SE.
But you get a better camera and it'll be way faster. That's the two differences. But
that's the thing. The guts of that thing are so much faster than what I've got in this phone now. And the price is so cheap that it's like, that is actually a long-term, like kind of, that's like a long-term play, basically. That's like,
yeah,
this is the least amount of money I can invest in my phone to get the maximum amount of longevity out of it, right?
Yeah.
Like that's why I wanted to replace it, was if I buy an SE right now, that phone is probably good for 3 or 4 years.
Well, this is one of those things, like This is why when we started testing, we were focusing on what the upgrade gives you, right? Like if the camera is a lot better and you use the camera a lot, it makes sense to upgrade. If the processor is faster, the internet connection is faster, and you're away from Wi-Fi or you're doing heavy lifting on that thing, yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
I feel like, and it's dangerous because you come into the when something new hits that actually is a significant improvement, like the jump from 1080 to 3080 or even 2080 to 3080 in a lot of cases. Is such that if you do like ray tracing workloads, that's a huge upgrade. There's maybe two games that have ray tracing workloads right now that are worth playing. And presumably that'll change in the spring when like Cyberpunk comes out and rolls out ray tracing and stuff like that. But it's a really, like if you're playing, the TLDR on this is if you're playing on a 7700 Intel processor and you have 1080p monitors, probably you're not going to see much of a difference between a 1080 Ti and a 3080. The frames will go up, but you're not going to notice unless you're running on a really high-end monitor or are a competitive esports player or something like that. So,
yeah.
And I always, like, you should spend the money that's right for you. And that's it. Like you don't have to have a 3090 and an i10900 or whatever it is to like play PC games. Yeah. I know a ton of people who play, I know like competitive PUBG streamers who are very good and are playing on like 1070s and stuff. Sure. Like that.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
Like, yeah.
I have always, my whole life, I have always bought the mid-range to budget graphics card, never the high end.
Well, and the other thing to remember, especially I say this as somebody who streams on Twitch like five nights a week. When you do that, you get access to hardware that you do not have to pay for. And that changes, like, do not look at what your favorite streamer does with the PC they have listed in the box below the stream as, well, shit, this is what I have to do if I want to play Call of Duty, or this is what I need like for Fall Guys or Among Us or whatever people are watching at any given moment. Like be aware that A, if there's something on their screen that has a logo on it, that they're getting paid, but like, yeah, they're worst case, they're probably not paying for hardware if they have a few hundred people watching, a few thousand people watching. Definitely.
Sure. Just to the emailer's point, my girlfriend hates this, but I hang on to everything I can. Like if I get a new router, I keep the old router goes in a drawer. It doesn't get tossed out because
I keep one generation back just in case something breaks, so I don't have to go to Best Buy to replace it.
Or there's been cases where like, oh, the previous Wi-Fi router I was using, I turned into a bridge that I could use to hook up a Netflix box in a room that didn't have good Wi-Fi signal otherwise, or something like that. You know, like there's always like finding a use for something old that I've had lying around. Like the longer I've had it without using it, the more satisfied I feel when I actually find something to do with it. Like that is way more satisfying to me than buying something new always.
Brad, I have a Kin phone in the garage that's calling your name. I think you should just fire that thing up. It's on Verizon. You can hook it up. You'll be good to go. You're gonna love it.
I'll figure something out.
It spins open, I think. I can't remember. It has a weird. Yeah.
I'll find a use for it. It's my specialty. All right. That's it. That's all the emails.
Yeah. Don't celebrate consumerism, yo.
Yeah.
It's bad.
Yeah. You know, the only other thing I was going to say is like, as long as you're disposing of your electronics responsibly, like it's not the worst thing, you know, like
you flush them down the toilet or something. What's the strategy?
Like as long as you're donating them or like finding another home for them, like just don't chuck stuff in the trash or whatever, you know, or like take it to an e-waste recycling place if you absolutely need to just toss it out, you know?
Yeah. Or give it to I don't do it anymore. Because my parents are hooked on that iPhone life and are regular upgraders now. But give them to friends, family, kids.
Yeah. Yes. Find a home for them. Maybe a library or something. Or, you know,
I don't think libraries take that stuff anymore. I think it's become too much of a problem.
Yeah, probably. I could see that. So,
but this is the part of the show. First off, if you have questions, you can send them to techpod@content.town. We answered them the last episode of every month, usually. Next week is, we hit 1,000 patrons last month. Mm-hmm. And we're reading, as a result, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is one of my favorite books that I hadn't read in a long time, I'm realizing.
I was going
to
ask, are you, in fact, rereading it, even though you've read it numerous times?
Oh yeah, okay. Of course. Okay. It's funny, though, because it's like, you know, do you have any movies that you've watched so many times you kind of don't have to watch them anymore? Yes. And you can just see them?
Totally.
It's like that. Like, yeah. I remember the jokes. The funny thing is that some things land differently now, because I definitely haven't read it since I had a kid. And really probably haven't read it since I was like a working adult. Probably the last time I read it was when I was at Maximum PC. So, yeah, it's been interesting. But we're going to be doing that next week or the week after. I think that's it. But this is we hit 1,000 patrons. We're already at 1,100 patrons now, because a lot of people like Hitchhiker's Guide. So we have to come up with a 2,000 patron stretch goal now, I guess.
You did name another book. I don't know if we're ready to go down that road yet or not.
I think we should talk. I think we need to have a conversation first, because it's a lot.
Yes.
But this is the part where we thank our patrons. If you want to get access to the TechPod Discord, where 1,000 beautiful, brilliant people share the stuff that they're interested in and talk to each other on the day to day. It is a fabulous, fabulous community. We both had the benefit of being part of a lot of communities that are amazing, but this one's special.
Yeah, I feel enriched every day I look at that server.
Yeah.
The other day in the coding channel, they had a long conversation about pseudo random number generators in games.
Ooh.
And they were literally like linking off to specific like files from the Doom source code and like making like mocking the ridiculously poor random number generator that Carmack came up with.
What did they use random number generators for in Doom?
I think it was. It may have been multiple things. I think the only example I saw was it might affect how the BFG behaves as the projectile travels or something like that.
Oh, wow.
But if I read correctly, he just defined a variable with like 256 values from 1 to 256 and it just cycled through them or something like that.
Jesus.
It was like a very poor. Anyway.
Did they talk about Perlin noise? Did that come out?
The term didn't come up, but they did mention like sampling entropy off of like buffers and other like hardware elements that you might be able to pull some like decent randomness off of. Completely fascinating stuff.
One of my favorite ones is that you can use the shitty nature of the quartz clock on most computers to generate some randomness because they bounce around constantly.
That's not bad.
Anyway, if you want to join that, you can go to patreon.com/techpod and sign up for $2 a month. You get access to the Discord. We do a monthly patron exclusive episode. Last month, we talked about projects that we were working on. It was stuff like Home Assistant and all of the weird, you know, all the stuff that we do.
Yeah.
In our free time. And this is the episode where we thank all of our executive and associate producer level patrons. So, shout outs to our executive producer patrons, Andrew Cotton, David Allen, and Jacob Chappell. Thank you all so much. And as well, our associate producer level patrons, Arthur Geese, Dan Brockman, Dave Ullian, Graham Banks, Jad Rita, Sam Buck, Terry Cox, and the Bunny Fiend.
Oh, the Bunny Fiend.
And Thomas Shea.
Cannot forget
shout out to the Bunny Fiend. Yo.
Cannot forget the Bunny Fiend.
No, never. You never put the Bunny Fiend in a corner, Brad. Yeah. That's important.
I mean, they're a fiend.
So I did not know.
You don't want to anger someone who is a fiend.
I mean, for bunnies though, yeah. Are they made of real bunnies or are they fiending the? I don't want to know. I'm good.
It's just yeah. Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much to everyone.
And thanks to everybody who supports the Patreon and the TechPod. We really appreciate it. Yeah. And I guess that's it for us this week. So read Hitchhikers. We're going to talk about that. And then, I don't know, if you have ideas for things you would like to see us talk about or do after we hit 2,000 patrons, I guess, post in the Discord, send us a Twitter message.
Or even without a patron goal attached to it, just like on Twitter or email, or if you're on the Discord there, anywhere is fine. But yeah, like topic suggestions are always welcome because there's a ton of stuff out there that we probably haven't thought of, and that would be super helpful to know what people...
Topic idea. Oh, the last thing is people had asked about annual, like signing up for a year rather than having to do the month-to-month, and we got the ability to flip that on since the last time we did an emails episode. So you can sign up for a year at whatever level you would like and just pay it all at once at a little bit of a discount. I think it's 5% off.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Cool.
Thank you all so much.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody.
Have a good week, Brad. I'll talk to you next week, man.